And it's 8:35 at KGNU. The Children of Deportation is up next. Here's KGNU's Claudia Craig.
And good morning, Joel, and good morning to all our listeners here at KGNU. The U.S. citizen children of deportees in the United States in general and in Colorado, it's a fraught subject of discussion, beset with all manner of emotion, legal niceties, and not-so-nice xenophobic agitprop that tends to come out like a horror story in the kind of extreme legislation that was introduced in the state of Arizona and which some quarters seek to spread and strengthen in others of the 50 states. To frame the discussion from the point of view of the children, many of whom are citizens by birthright and who are affected when one or both of their parents is deported or threatened with deportation, we're going to listen first to two young people who know the situation all too well at first hand. For this, we are going to be joined right here in the studio now by Jennifer Piper of the AFSC Colorado. That's a local branch of the American Friends Service Committee, who through their immigrant rights program works to create public discourse and policy that supports immigrants' full human rights and creates just, diverse communities. As a founding member of the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition, the AFSC collaborates with groups across the state to highlight the root causes of immigration and find humane responses to it. Welcome, Jennifer. Now, you're Jennifer Piper, but everybody calls you Piper. That's right, isn't it, Piper?
That's correct.
Welcome. Thank you for coming in to KGNU.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Judith Marquez of Colorado's Rights for All People, whose mission it is to do a lot of the same whose mission it is to bring the voices of immigrant leaders and their allies to the struggle for equality, mutual respect, and justice in the Metro Denver area through education, through community organizing, and successful campaigns. They began in 1994 as a response to the passage of the anti-immigrant legislation then. That was the Prop 187 in California when they hired their first staff, and that was by 2003. So welcome, Judith Marquez, to KGNU.
Good morning, Claudia. Thank you for having us.
We're delighted to have you. Now, I think, as I said, what's unusual about KGNU and what's, I think, unusual about a lot of your work is that this concerns children, and we very rarely get to hear from the children who are affected. We had the good fortune to speak to two exceptional young men who are only in their teens. They sound much too mature for their age. I suspect it's the difficulty of their situation has forced the maturity on them. But let's listen carefully to what they had to say, because they raise a lot of points I think adults don't make or don't feel they can make. A lot of listeners may have heard a little snippet of this, but the whole conversation is worth listening, and then we can have a full discussion. And we will be taking your calls, so please call to 303-442-4242, and we look forward to speaking to you. Now let's listen to these boys about their father.
My father, he's facing his last hearing and deportation. And he could leave as late as August or as early as, we don't even know.
Well, it's kind of like the cliche, there's an elephant sitting in the room. It's always there. It's always just staring at you in the face. But most of us, we just try to ignore what's going on. Like, until it happens, we're not going to deal with it. Or at least, we're not going to think about the negative sides of it.
Day to day, it doesn't have the biggest effect on our life. But it certainly is there. Yes, we're citizens. Yes, we're born here. I'm asked a lot, how is this possible? And, you know, I honestly have no idea. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. Beyond that, I really don't have much to say, because I don't know enough law.
Well, I guess it all comes down to that... In America, people have always been against immigration. Like, once, now that we're here, it's us, it's ours. That's why it's U.S., you know, us. And I think that's how this can happen. And it's all about just, I don't know, people just aren't fair like that here. Like, we're supposed to be the greatest place, but we're not. Not right now.
There is a lot of ignorance. A lot of people don't know. Like I said, people ask me, how is this possible? Because they honestly have no idea that it is possible. They don't know anything, honestly, because there's no publicity, there's no exposure at all. So, honestly, there's nothing that you can really do besides educate people to begin with.
I think it's pretty dumb, and it shows that there are a lot of ignorant people out there. I think there are probably some people that they really don't care about what's going on because they're self-centered. But I think a lot of it's ignorance. Like, if everyone knew someone in this situation, they would be against it. And this wouldn't be a problem if everyone knew about this.
I also feel the media has a bit to tie into it. There are those bits of news that do get through and actually kind of show the true side of any story, really. But other than that, it's there are those people who have the loudest voices and the biggest coverage, and so, you know, they get out there, and those are usually the people who are like, oh, I don't give a damn, you know, or they don't know. So, you know, they're, like, it goes back to, like, the lack of exposure to the problem. And we watched the Dream Act go through the houses, and you know what? After CRI was, or Comprehensive Immigration Reform was shot down, that was in a way, our last hope that anything could be put through.
Well, normally I'm pretty positive about the issues. Like, I work with an immigration task force at our church, but when I heard that they're going to introduce the Dream Act, I have to say I wasn't really watching out for it because I had a deep feeling inside that it wasn't going to pass. So whether or not it passed, I wasn't surprised because it's just, immigration's just too big of a debate so far for it to be passed now. Well, based off of how immigration people have acted towards immigration across U.S. history, I'm positive that it will change and that this won't be a problem for Latinos or any much longer. But it's not going to happen right away, I don't think. But I think it will happen, because sooner or later the populations will change enough that there will be positive change for immigration.
People who are already here, they want to just get rid of it so that they don't have any problems anymore. I do have this to say, because of the nature of the issue, it is our only hope that there will be some type of change towards the better for humane laws, for humane just treatment of people who are undocumented. Just any, that's the only hope, is that we will get a positive change other than, you know, providing for families and such.
I do think that there is part of it being racially motivated. A lot of people I know that I speak to, like at school, or that I've heard teachers talk about just in general, because of my economics class, you know, it's economics. Immigration is economics. Everything's economics. And there's definitely a lot of factors in this that aren't racial, but then when you get to some people, a lot of people will make statements that say that some pretty crazy things, and you know that that's not based off of sound logic, that's it's racism. It's based off of race.
I don't see how it isn't. The biggest problem with racism is that we are not looking at facts of what our makeup is, our genetic makeup is. We are basing it simply off of appearances, off of what we're afraid of just the whole problem with this is that we as a nation cannot agree on what we want to stick with and what we want to believe in. And there are so many people out there who are afraid of what they don't understand that we are going nowhere. I don't see how it isn't. Thanks to current legislation, we are in deadlock almost 24/7. I don't see anything happening. I know he will be fine. He can make it almost anywhere. He's the strongest man I've ever met. But when it comes to laws, nothing's happening. I don't see anything happening. The hope I have will only come in time, that we will get legislation passed that will allow him to come back, that will allow pathways to citizenship for people who need to be here or want to stay here, that any of this is resolved.
I feel it's the same, that that currently there's nothing's going to happen that's good, that it's all going to be either not even nothing's going to happen, or if anything happens, it's going to be worse. But if when he gets sent out, because I'm almost positive now that he will be, and that there's not much that can save him from being sent out, he'll be fine in Mexico, because I'm hoping it's straightforward, and he can make his own plans about what he knows to do. Like, he made it here, he can probably make it there. I mean, it's probably not that much harder. And I have faith in him. It's going to be tougher here. yeah, I don't know what else to say.
What else is there left to do? We just have to keep on living, you know, take care of our sister, our mom, keep going to school, working out what we have to do. I mean, I'm not going to give up everything just because I'm losing one person. I mean, I'm going to miss them like hell, but there's not much I really can do.
So that was it. There's not much he really can do. Two young gentlemen talking about the state of their father's immigration status and his likely deportation from the country. This is 8:46 a.m. KGNU Denver Boulder. We're here in the studio.
We're
here in the studio with Jennifer Piper of the American Friends Service Committee in Colorado and Judith Marquez of Colorado's Rights for All People. I don't know which one of you wants to start, but there's so much in that that is really horrifying. Racism, their absolute lack of hope, their lack of belief that the American political system can in fact provide any kind of solution. On the good side, their realization that the demographics of the country are changing, and mercifully that will bring some relief. Just this past week, there was news about 1 to 3-year-olds are now predominantly non-white. So maybe the force of the demographic change will bring something good out of it. Which one of you, Jennifer, Piper or Judith? How do you respond to this?
I mean, I think, first of all, I really want to thank you for having us here and for having that interview from their perspective. I think one thing that people don't realize is that most people in this country who are immigrants live in mixed status families, just like the one we just heard from, where one or more people is undocumented. Some people may have visas. Some people have citizenship. Sometimes the child is the only person in the family who is without status or who's undocumented. Sometimes the parent is the only person in the family. And that is all because of this complicated immigration system that makes it really hard for families to come through the process together. And I think all of the points they raised are super valid about the way that our debate happens, that some of our debate can be about the facts, but oftentimes, sadly, it's not about the facts. It's about fear, and it's about people that we feel like we don't know or that are might be different from us when actually they aren't that different.
And I just also like to highlight what the two teenagers said, that a lot of people don't know what's happening. Like, a lot of people don't know that it's their neighbors, you know, it's their friends, it's people that they know that are affected. And I think it's wonderful that you're able to interview these young men, because they are, you know, showing a voice and in some cases the face of the victims of our current system that is really unjust and is separating families.
Right, but they mentioned racism. Now, how big a part of the equation is this? Because it seems to me that this is no longer just perceived. It seems to be actual. I mean, there is evidence of people being beaten up. There have been various prosecutions around the country to address the hate crimes of racism. Some American citizens who happen to be Mexican were beaten up, and we hear about it all the time. We see what goes on in Arizona. But is that what really people don't want to tackle? Or is it because it's racism that in some quarters people think it's perfectly fine? I mean, there are some elements we know who actually think it's okay to be racist.
Yeah,
Piper.
I think that the debate in this country since the founding of the country has been around race and who an American is and how we define what that is. In the 1700s, you have Benjamin Franklin saying that he doesn't think Pennsylvania should be a part of the Union because Germans will never assimilate. They'll never learn English. And they drank beer. Germans are who brought us beer. Yay, Germans. But the debate has always been one about who is part of who's white enough to be American. And over time, that's excluded African Americans, excluded the Irish. It's excluded the Chinese from being able to legalize their status and be full citizens of this country. And really what we do is we make a second class group when
so
we
they're
keep
the
people
other
apart.
They're not really one of us.
And the impact on children of that who've been growing up here their entire lives, whether they have status or not, is that they are rejected by the country they live in, and they're not accepted as full members of this country, and their families are impacted by these kinds of policies in a real way that gets at the heart of their identity and their ability to be a part of this country. We're rejecting them.
And we would like to take your calls. Please do call and speak if you like to Judith Marquez of Rights for All People or Piper, Jennifer Piper of the AFSC Colorado. Judith, this past week on Monday, Representative Randy Baumgardner, the Republican from Hot Sulphur Springs, killed his House Bill 1107, but not out of any wonderful newly found altruism. But he said the concerns about the cost of fighting off legal attacks questioning the bill's constitutionality. Now, you led a rearguard action to fight this bill, didn't you? What happened?
Yes, on Monday, the Colorado Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition, which makes up about over 60 organizations, which Rights for All People and AFSC is part of, we held our press conference and rally to speak out against Arizona copycat laws that basically integrate the local police in immigration issues at an extreme level. This was going to allow police officers to stop people on the street and ask them for their documentation, their status, their immigration status.
Based on?
They have probable suspicion that they're undocumented. And that's where the issue
based
is.
Based on what? Their color?
Well, exactly. We are in firm belief that it would cause an extreme amount of racial profiling, you know, based on skin color. Because, you know, we know that if you are a little brown, you know, you are not, like Piper was saying, you know, you still not considered, you know, part of this country.
I think people forget Colorado is, in fact, you know, it's a Spanish name, but I think people choose to forget that. And also, Judith, just before he left the office for Colorado, the former governor, Bill Ritter, signed into law, didn't he, for Colorado's participation in the Secure Communities Program. And this is a program of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to create a national fingerprint database that allows people booked into jail to be checked against the Department of Homeland Security. I.e., you can pull someone over for a traffic misdemeanor and they can find themselves on the road to deportation. Is that correct?
Yes. And right now in Colorado, we have actually a law. It's called SB 90. And it says that if you're detained by police and they think you're undocumented, they will report you to ICE.
And if they think, this is what I'm getting at, if they think in their infinite wisdom as a law enforcement officer that you are not a real American for any reason, accent, color, any reason, they can pull you in.
And
Piper.
The impact on this, on community safety, is huge. And because the person who's actually making that determination or trying to guess whether you're documented or not is the sheriff at the county jail. So it's based on your arrests. You know, they're the ones who report you to ICE. But what the community perceives is that the police are the ones who are pulling people over and that the police are the ones who are directly reporting people to ICE. And what we see for kids is when they when they witness a crime, when they are a victim of crime, if they have family members who are undocumented or without status, or if they themselves are without status, they're oftentimes very afraid to call the police. They, you know, when I was growing up, I saw police officers as people that could help me if I got in a bind. And some of that's because I'm white also. But these kids don't see police officers in that way because of our broken immigration system, because of the fact that they know their parents are at risk, or they themselves are at risk of being deported to a country where they haven't been in years.
And also with the SB 90, like you said, Claudia, we know there's like about 80% of people that are in detention center right now have been put there because of traffic violation, minor traffic violations. And there's children in those vehicles when they get pulled over. And when a police officer pulls over their parent, it is a traumatic experience because they know that any contact with authority, you know, can lead to, you know, the parents being completely gone, being separated.
And we do have a call. Robert, are you there in Boulder? Would you like to talk, please, to Jennifer Piper of the AFSC or Judith Marquez of Rights for All People? Robert, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Well, whoever wants to respond, I'd like to bring up a point that seems to get lost in the shuffle often in this discussion. I myself am from Colorado. I'm a U.S. citizen. I have welcomed many immigrants from all over the world to what I consider to be my country, my state, my town, county. I've sponsored people to become citizens myself. And I think it's all very healthy and wonderful. Excuse me. And I understand the the factors of prejudice and fear that work in our society to try to keep others out. But I also understand that there's an issue of self-determination here and everywhere in the world. Do people in any country or state or city have a right to determine who becomes a citizen, who shares that place that perhaps you and your heritage and your culture has been for hundreds or perhaps thousands of years? And I think that many people from the U.S. do not respect that right. In other countries, we invade and wreak havoc in other cultures. And I guess I just would like to have that point be part of the discussion that perhaps we do at least have a right to here in this country to say how many people do we think we can sustain here. What are the requirements of citizenship? And then, of course, there's the one that comes up that should people who follow the process that we have determined here be waiting in line respectfully while others slip through and do it and come illegally?
Well, Robert, thank you very much for that point. Piper of the AFSC would like to respond.
Yeah, thank you for your question, Robert. I think it raises a point that's really important, which is that the answer to your question isn't just black and white. So there is over 60% of the people who are here undocumented came originally with a visa. Many of those visas don't allow people to renew their status. So a lot of people who are undocumented actually did wait in line. And then because of an error in paperwork or because they couldn't renew their visa because it's not allowed on certain types of visas, then they stayed longer. And I agree with you. I think that countries do have a right to self-determination. But I think that self-determination needs to also contain provisions for justice and for humanity and for humane practices. So the issue with our system right now is that it doesn't encourage people to go through the process, that the wait time for someone who's applying for their child from especially countries of color is oftentimes 10, 15, 20 years. So if you apply for your 3-year-old to come and you're a U.S. citizen, waiting until they're 23 is not a viable option for most parents. So the current system that we have has such huge backlogs that you have to wait that long just to get a yes or a no. And the reality is none of us would wait that long for our family. I would not wait that long to see my family. So what we're asking for is that we have policies that are logical, that are humane, that allow people to come here in a transparent and quick manner, and also that address people who are living here undocumented currently. And many of those people become undocumented because our system is so narrow. You have to be perfect person to be able to become a U.S. citizen. If you made a mistake 20 years ago, oftentimes when you apply for citizenship, that mistake is what gets you deported. It's what takes your status away. And so we're not only talking about people without status, we're talking about legal permanent residents, over 100,000 of whom have been deported and separated from their U.S. citizen children.
Thank you for that, Robert. A very important point.
Can I ask one quick more question?
Yes, please go ahead. Yes, please do.
On the one point about people who have, you say, have waited that had a visa that expired, and why should they be deported or not be allowed here? I don't understand that point, because when you get a visa, you know it's for a limited period of time. There is no guarantee that it's going to be renewed. I go to another country with a certain period of time granted to me. Why should I expect that I would be entitled to stay in some other country longer than they gave me?
Well, Robert, I think that's a complicated point when a lot of the American growth in the economy has depended on 12 million illegal workforce. It has suited America, I would imagine, quite well to have a lot of undocumented workers. But thank you very much for your call. We do have an email from Judy in Denver who said this, and she'd like to know from both of you, do these children have any recourse? Is there an organization or a legal or rights group that can or will organize to help the children, specifically the children? And then we have a call from Laurel from Boulder. One second, Laurel. But what about Judy's question? What recourse do these kids have, like the two kids on the tape?
Here locally, there's a lot of organizations that work with teenagers. We have Voice in Boulder. There's Padres and Jóvenes Unidos in Denver. There is Life in Longmont. They all work with mostly high school students that they worked really hard last year to pass the DREAM Act. And, you know, and their energy is amazing. I think that for young people that are facing this horrible situation, it's so inhumane, separating their families, you know, I think joining these groups, you find hope that those children right now that were interviewed, they're losing, you know, and it's so terrible to hear such young people losing hope in this country and in this system, right?
And Laurel from Boulder, are you there? Laurel, have we or have we lost you? Laurel, if there, maybe she'll come back in a moment. Piper.
And just to add on to what Judy said, I think there are many organizations that help youth find a voice and that promote the perspective of U.S. citizen children. I also think, though, to answer the question more specifically, no, there is no recourse for children whose parents have final orders of deportation. The way that our system works, the ICE official who is charged with picking you up and deporting you has more discretion to decide on your case than the judge who later reviews that deportation order. So in many cases, the immigration judge themselves, their hands have been tied by our laws over the last 10 years to a place where they cannot take into account the impact on the U.S. citizen child of deportation. So in this case, because the kids are under 21, they can't apply for their father. You can't apply for your for citizenship or legal status for a parent until you're 21.
And also there's a point, I think in some cases, people don't understand that if a father is deported like this, he's actually barred from ever coming back, forever. That's a pretty daunting concept.
And I think the deeper question we have to ask ourselves, too, is, you know, we're talking about a piece of paper that we make the rules around how people get that piece of paper. And do the consequences that we're enacting on people, that we're separating children from their parents, do those consequences match up with the lack of a piece of paper? And I think that's where issues of race and deservedness come into the debate, is that people forget that we're arguing over literally a piece of paper, which is why it doesn't make sense to any child or anyone who looks at it from a logical perspective that this is the consequence for not having paper, indefinite detention and deportation.
Well, it's 9:05 here at KGNU, and we do welcome your calls on this discussion, the children that are affected by deportation. We've had Robert on, made some very good points, and emails we've had. Please do give us a call, 303-442-4242. What I want to hear from you, Piper, you and I've heard some stories. I wish they were stories. They are not fabulous. They're absolutely true. You go to the deportation center, and it's a commercial organization, isn't it? I mean, can we clarify that? Because I think people just think it's justice and due process, and indeed it is enforcing due process. But what part does the commercial aspect of deportation play?
So the way that detention works in Colorado is that once you are picked up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, you're then transported either to a county jail that receives money from the federal government to hold you, or to the GEO Detention Center. And GEO is a corporation that's worldwide, that is for profit, and $130 per day per detainee is what we pay out of our tax money to this corporation located in Aurora, Colorado.
What are the numbers in Colorado and Denver specifically? What are the numbers of deportation we're talking about?
Well, in detention every day, there's usually about 500 people in the GEO Corporation's detention center alone, and then an additional anywhere between 0 to 150 people being held in county jails around the state. And we spend, as a nation, we spend $2.5 billion last year on detaining immigrants, over 80% of whom had no criminal charges.
$2.5 billion. And we've just had all these tax cuts, cutting heating assistance, cutting this, that, and the other. What are this administration's this current administration, now people hope for difference, what is the current administration's record on all of this deportation? What about this hope we heard so much about?
Right. It has been shown that under Obama there has been a lot of deportations, but it also was continued from, you know, the administration of Bush. Since then, it's been...
Last year, we deported about 400,000 people and are on target
from
to
Colorado?
No, from the U.S.
The states. 400,000.
And are on track to deport 450,000 people this year. And the goal of Immigration's Customs Enforcement, the 10-year goal, is to deport every deportable person by 2013. That means everyone. It means not, doesn't matter what your criminal history is, doesn't matter how long you've been here, doesn't matter how many taxes you've paid.
No negotiation.
Their goal is to deport everyone.
And the children. Now, Maeve Conran and Joel Edelstein did some exemplary coverage of the Swift raids up in Greeley. What happened to the children then, and what is, you both are very in touch with them. What has happened to them since? What is their situation? They're citizens. Their parents have gone. What is their situation?
So many of the people picked up in that raid were actually from Guatemala. Many of the people in those raids, they faced language barriers beyond just not being able to speak English, but also a lack of Spanish, and that counted against them in proceedings. So many of the children were away from their parents, separated from their parents for 3 to 6 months while their parents were being detained in Texas, in the hope that those parents, you know, while Immigration and Customs Enforcement was pressuring them to sign their own deportation, which would bar them from coming back to the U.S. So during that time, what we saw was kids who had increased fear, had increased anxiety, who couldn't sleep, who couldn't eat, kids who became, with older kids, became angry, became withdrawn. there was a lot of community support, but that's not the same thing as having your parent in your house with you.
But in some cases, both parents had to leave. Who then, to whom was the responsibility of looking after? Did it fall back on the community?
In many cases, it did. And in some cases, there were family members who would have been able to take kids in but weren't allowed to because of their status. So those kids ended up in foster care, although that was a very small number. And here's some of what I'm talking about in terms of timeliness. That happened in 2006. There are still people fighting their case through the immigration courts who have not received a yes or a no, who have not been allowed to work that entire time, who have been on ankle bracelets that entire time. And that has an impact on the family as well. Taking away the main wage earner from a family has a huge impact on children, and it creates a huge stress for everyone in the family when you don't know how long you'll have to wait to get an answer. You can't plan for the future that way.
I've heard a horrifying thing. I've done stories out on the street when I have for immigration with so-called illegals, people who do not have the right to be here. And I was really surprised that, and I've discussed this with you, Piper, and I think Judith too, some of the most vocal opposition to allowing people to stay is coming from new immigrants or people just about to get full immigrant status. I.e. people who were, till just a few months ago, often in a perilous situation themselves as far as their paperwork was concerned. It surprised me. But one of the boys on the tape said, well, you know, it's us. Once we're here, the door is shut. And, you know, too bad if you haven't got in yet because it's shut. Do you really find that? I found that in maybe five instances where I had quite vocal, rather people telling me, you know, it's shut. It's okay. We're here. And we've got to stop it now. Do you find that? I find it hard to believe. I'd like to think those were exceptions.
I think it's like a minority. But, you know, it is there. And also, I think it's just part of that, sentiment in the U.S., like, we don't have a lot of unity, you know, in between our communities. You know, undocumented people are part of our communities. There are students, there are friends, there are, you know, they're part of our community. And it's just a sentiment of, like, you know, I'm protecting mine, you know, and I don't care about the rest of the people. But that's not the country that I want. And I know that we have plenty in this country. We have plenty. And it's just a matter of, you know, caring for the other. They might not look like you, but they're valuable. They're a person. And a lot of the undocumented population is hardworking, trying to succeed in this country. And finding ways, like entrepreneurship, just finding ways to survive. So we need to unite as a country.
And what about, Piper, the question of the move around America to actually change the current status where a child born here is a United States citizen? Because this seems to be gathering a ferocity that I find extraordinary.
Yeah, I think first I would like to explain a little bit about the history of the 14th Amendment. So the 14th Amendment did grant birthright citizenship to anyone who's born in the United States. And part of the reason for that is previous to the 14th Amendment, states did not have to follow the federal U.S. Constitution. So previous to the 14th Amendment, states decided which rights they would recognize from the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and they decided who could become a citizen. And so that was based on the majority. So in a state like Pennsylvania, you would see that mostly people of German descent could easily become citizens and everyone else could not. In a state where white English Protestants were the majority, that's who could become citizens. So this is about more than immigration. It's also about a movement to detach states from the Constitution so unconstitutional things like the Arizona copycat law can become law. That's what it's about. It's about more than immigration, that movement.
More than immigration, indeed. We have several calls we'd like to get to. We have Laura, and we have Nishala and Myron. You've been very patient. Lauren first. Are you there, please? No, Lauren. Nishala, are you there? Nishala,
yes,
forgive me if I've got your name wrong. Please go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Hello?
Please go ahead.
So I actually have another side of the issue. I have a husband who just finally received his permanent green card, but we went through a real hellacious time. I met him when I was living in India. I'm from America, born and raised here, and I came home when I was pregnant because I didn't want to give birth in India because I was working in the healthcare field over there, and I didn't want to do that. So I came home, I gave birth, and my husband was not even allowed to come into the country for my child's birth. It took us 22 months to get him through the immigration process, largely in part because he's a Tibetan refugee, and he was from India. And so there are certain countries where you can't just get visas. And so I had huge issues, even within my fellow Tibetan population friends, of people who came over on visas, overstayed their visa, expired their visas, and then threw out their passports and claimed refugee status. Now, these are friends. I love these people. But here I was, a U.S. American citizen, born and raised here, was not able to have my husband at the birth of my child. I was in school pursuing the final part of my alternative Tibetan medicine degree. I had to get on welfare. I had to get on food stamps. My family had to pay to help get me through the situation, and I was separated from my husband until my child was 14 months old. And part of my anger and irritation about the immigration system is that they are not taking into account that there are people that have families that legitimately should be allowed to come in. And when we tried to even apply for, like, urgency, like emergency situation, they said that my case wasn't even urgent enough that I should have sort of advanced.
Well, Nishala, thank you very much for that. I mean, you're talking about an almighty mess, it seems to me. It's a hodgepodge,
yeah,
isn't it? Let's get Piper or Judith. Judith, what about this mess? What Nishala is saying, this is inconsistency. That, you know, we're told it's a system and that it's fair and you wait and you do your bit and it'll all be sorted. Clearly, that's not the case. We've just heard Nishala's comments.
And thank you so much, Nishala, for sharing that story. Nishala is one person out of thousands and thousands and thousands of families that are facing the same situation, that they can't bring, you know, their loved one here, or they can't stay in this country with their loved ones, with their parents, with their support, you know, financial, emotional, you know, everything.
I know, but I'm from here, you know, and it's not fair, and the system...
Yes, but what you're saying, Nishala, it doesn't actually make any difference. We've discussed that. Piper has something to add.
Yeah, I think the point that she brings up also is that one of the things that immigration looks at is these cases of extreme hardship, and what she's highlighting is that when they say extreme, they mean extreme. A hardship of having to give birth by yourself without your husband there and your child not knowing his father until he's, 2 years old, that's not extreme hardship in the eyes of the immigration system because of the laws that we've created, because of the laws that we as a country have created together in this sort of web of unmanageableness. You know, the only law more complicated than immigration law is tax law. It is not straightforward. And I would bet that she spent thousands of dollars getting this visa through the system. It is expensive.
Nishala, did you have to spend?
It cost me about
in itself stops an awful lot of people from sorting out the situation. Money. Well,
that's what I'm saying. I had to go.
Yep.
I'm a college-educated person, and I had to go on welfare because the system is so broken that in order for me to just support myself and my child through help of my family and the system, that's not what should be happening in America. So I'll leave the comments to you, and I'll say thank you, but I just wanted to say that it's a bigger thing than just the borders of America. So, I mean, it's, you know, on the northern and southern border, because I had to fly to India in order for my son to meet his father. And that just, you know, that just shouldn't happen.
Well, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, it seems that this is a mess. I mean, an almighty mess. Let me just check. Do we have Lauren on the line? We had Lauren. She's called twice, I think, very patiently. Are you there, Lauren? No, Lauren. Do we have Myron?
Yes, that's me.
Myron, yes. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to speak a little bit on the economics of it and then overall my view. The economics of it is that there's an industry now creating jobs to house in our prison people of different ethnicities, besides the industry of returning them to their country or just over the border. And it's also not a conspiracy, I don't believe, but the white businessman who goes down and picks up some guys to work dirt cheap and half the time stiffs them, they don't know where they're at, and he gives them a ride, they have to use the bathroom, and he takes off. All the atrocities we knew about in the 70s are still occurring today, and back then they just gave an overall amnesty to people who could prove they'd been here whatever time or more, and we'll get back to it later, which of course they never did. Those atrocities still exist because there's a lack of jobs, and we are building a society where prisons are privately owned, and who doesn't want to grow your business? So, also, why do I want to have to pay somebody $10 or $12 an hour to come in and work in my home if I can go down the street and get guys for $4 an hour? And it feeds a whole bunch of people back where they live. They're desperate for that money. They have no other source of income. That's why the person came up here. But the changes never occurred because there's no money in it. There's no lobbyists going to the congressman and saying, please go talk about this in Congress. Go start a debate on this in Congress.
Well, Myron, you make some very, very good points. I think one of the kids, if you heard them speaking, they said that economics was a huge part of this. And you've laid that out very clearly. Let's hear what Piper or Judith have to say.
Yeah, thank you for those comments. I think they're, the piece around industry is really huge, and it's bigger than immigration as well, where we see private, here in Colorado, we have a private immigration detention center, but then we also have six or seven private prisons that the state pays to hold people who've been convicted of crimes. And that this is one of the few, we're creating a society where one of the few places you can find work as a working class person is in these private prison industries, especially in smaller towns out on the plains and in the mountains, where the main source of employment for people living in those towns is the prison industry. And I think that's a bigger question that we need to ask ourselves. And then the other piece that you raised around wages, I think, is really important, because most immigrants don't want to accept $4 an hour. And the larger issue there is that with our laws, we've created a whole class of people who don't feel protected by our labor laws. And in many cases where immigrants have joined unions, they've been able to raise the bar and the floor for benefits and pay for everyone, citizen, immigrant, undocumented, or documented. And so I think the issue for the working class is finding ways to unite and support one another regardless of our status in order to raise the floor for everyone so that people can't find that person who's really vulnerable.
Judith, do you have something to say to Myron's comments?
Yeah, also, I'm talking about personal experience here. All the people that I know, I have the family that are undocumented, everyone here works, they sacrifice so much. They work two jobs, they work all day, and just the fact that these people are being criminalized by our current laws and just the language of this issue is wrong. And not only that, but they contribute to our country every single day that they wake up early in the morning to go to work. So I think we need to, again, respect, you know, humans, respect the value that they give to us.
We've got a few minutes left. It's 303-442-4242. If you'd like to speak to Jennifer Piper of the FSC. Oh, yes, Myron, please go ahead.
Yes, I also wanted to say that the 2000 census, I don't know about the 2010, but in the 2000 census, it was found that the number one group of immigrants, number one country that they came from into America, was not a Latino country. It was Japan. And they fly here in planes. They don't have to risk death in the desert. Okay. Bye.
Thank you, Myron. Thank you for your points. We've got only a few minutes left. I would like to get back to the children. That is the point of this. And these, specifically, the United States, so these are citizens. So they seem to find themselves in an invidious position. I'd like you both to wrap up with what you think might happen. Obviously, you don't have a crystal ball. None of us do. But the demographic issue is something I'd like to discuss. And in the last few minutes, I'd like to know, how does the United States compare on the human rights level, with not the legal level? With the legal level is something that has to be respected. Due process is, of course, something we have to respect. I'm interested in comparative situations between, I don't know, EU countries, or, you know, we hear that everybody has to respect visas. In some countries, what happens if people don't? The human rights situation of a child who is a citizen in a country and his parents are thrown out. Do we have information on that, Piper or Judith?
I have some general information on that, which is that migration is a much bigger issue than just the United States and people coming here. At this point in history, more people are migrating around the world than in any other point in time. And it's mainly because goods and capital, money and products can cross borders easily, and people who provide labor and who are the underpinning of that system cannot. And that creates a lot of inequities around the world. So we see people moving all around the world and migrating for increasingly economic reasons that we didn't see in the past.
And it was a knock-on of free trade, wasn't it? I mean, everybody was going hoopla for free trade.
And this is the consequence of free trade, is a lot of people dislocated. And what we see across the world is increasing detention. What we see is increasing deportation. We see increasing death in trying to migrate. And we see that in the EU, where North African countries are paid to keep Africans from other parts of the continent from getting into Europe. And many people disappear in that process.
Well, just yesterday in Italy, they, you know, shut down a whole town, which is... So, I mean, by no means is the United States the worst or... But it is, we do know children here in this situation. Judith, do you have some final comments?
Yes, I just want to say, like, what country do we want? What kind of USA do we want? I think one of the standards here is family, right? Like
Well, so we're told.
Right, exactly. But it's not happening. You know, we're allowing this to happen, for moms to be torn away from their children and their parents. What does your mom mean to you? What does your family mean to you? It means support. It means, like I said, emotional support. And we're taking that away. And I think for the U.S. Population, we just need to stand up for the best values that we have, which are family, freedom, justice. We need to stand up for those.
And Piper?
And I think building on that, we need to respect the contributions that people make. You know, the Social Security Fund has more than $6 billion in it from people who are working, who are undocumented. They pay into our tax system and are a net benefit in that way. And beyond that, as individuals, as human beings, they are our friends and our family. And I want to reiterate that most families have one, you know, just like the woman who called in, one parent is a U.S. citizen who's lived here for generations. Another parent is going through the visa process or is undocumented. Sometimes both parents are citizens and their children are undocumented. So it's not any longer some monolithic group that you can just disappear without impact, which would also be wrong. But it's about really the fabric of our society. 7% of kids in the U.S. live in mixed-status families, 7%.
And it was ever thus. But we have a minute left. I'd like to thank Jennifer Piper of the AFC Colorado, the local branch of the American Friends Service Committee, and Judith Marquez of Colorado's Rights for All People. Do you have optimism that this situation for these children and children in their same circumstance will be resolved successfully soon?
For me, it's challenging to wake up to see a bunch of legislation. Right now we have over 7 bills in Colorado that are targeting immigrant communities. And I have hope in the people.
I agree. I think there's hope for change because immigrant community members are standing up for themselves and allies are supporting them. But we need listeners to get involved. If you are listening and you do not agree with this, you need to contact one of our organizations because your silence is what allows this to happen. Your silence.
Well, thank you, Jennifer Piper, and thank you, Judith Marquez. You should stay tuned now to the Morning Sound Alternative, and stay tuned, and thank you very much for listening this morning to KGNU.